The views and opinions expressed by the guests of the DiploSport podcast do not necessarily represent the official policy or position of any agency of the United States government or any organization, public or private.
Greetings, friends, and welcome to the latest edition of the DiploSport podcast. Today's episode is a real treat because I got to speak with one of my longtime friends, actually a guy I went to high school with named Tom Beer. Tom's now a reporter for Basketball Insiders, and he gets to cover his dream beat, the New York Knicks. I wanted to talk to Tom on the record because of a wonderful piece that he recently wrote covering the rise of Kristaps Porzingis, a Latvian basketball player who's taken the U.S. by storm, taken New York by storm, and also taken his home country of Latvia by storm. And Tom wrote about some of the fans that stay up all night watching the Knicks just because they have Porzingis fever halfway around the world, and they're able to take a lot of pride in this national hero. I thought that the piece really went hand in hand with what I'm trying to accomplish with the podcast, kind of showing how sports flatten borders, promote understanding, bring people together. I'll let you judge for yourself. I'll put a link to the story in the show notes and turn things over to me and Tom Beer. So we are in the man cave in Belrose on the Nassau side of the border.
Okay. Yes, sir.
Nassau County, born and bred Long Island. And that other voice you hear is one of my oldest friends. It's Tommy Beer, my fellow Chaminade classmate, and now the senior basketball analyst at Basketball Insiders. He's living the dream as a basketball journalist. And how long have you been writing?
Sure. So my path to covering the NBA was a circuitous one. I went to school up in Holy Cross.
Got it. Crusaders.
Crusaders. Patriot League represent.
You played ball.
I played JV. Actually, we played against a few up in New England, is the kind of the prep school capital
sure.
of the world, you know. So guys that can't get their grades quite right will go to prep school for a year or two.
Yep.
And one of the teams they schedule in their season is JV Holy Cross Hoops team.
Who's the best guy you ever played against?
Caron Butler.
Okay.
Caron Butler. And there was a couple of the Jerome Owusu went to UCLA, and there was a couple of the guys that made it to the NBA, but Butler was the even playing against him, you knew, like, obviously this guy was a different caliber.
Did you lock him down though?
Yeah, exactly. I dunked on him. So I was a econ grad. Went to work for a mutual fund company in Boston after I graduated from school for a couple of years. Realized that wasn't for me. Had a lot of fun in Boston, but realized it was time to probably move home. Went back home, and during that time, obviously, I'd been an immense sports fan my whole life.
Always
from the time I was a kid.
I remember your childhood bedroom was just wallpaper with Sports Illustrated covers and the dunk with Starks on. Oh, I can see it. I can see it. It's still hanging up.
There's one of the few things that I've brought every place I've ever lived. I've had that dunk poster hanging on my wall, as I do in here. So I never seriously considered working for an NBA, you know, being involved in the NBA or sports in any way, shape, or form. To be honest, kind of a dream or a diversion. A few years after graduating from school, reading more and more, I would have conversations with my friends over email, voice my opinion about who the Knicks should draft, what they should do with their salary cap space, yada, 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 about a bunch of different sports. But at this point in my life, basketball is definitely a number one. One of the sites I read at that time most frequently was hoopsworld.com. And I'm reading one day, and they had a kind of a help wanted, basically, a help wanted ad posted on their homepage. I emailed the editor, a gentleman, Steve Kyle, who lives down in Florida, still runs which has now become Basketball Insiders Today. We kind of had a conversation about, what it would take and what I was interested in. Sent him a few writing samples, and he said, okay, let's, get your feet, wet. Basically, what I did was, it was called the morning shoot around. So I would copy and paste links from the Detroit Free Press, the Los Angeles Times, you know,
like
whatever.
Like Buster Olney does for ESPN.
Yeah, basically, just an amalgamation.
With baseball.
Of, yeah, just put all the pertinent stuff in one you know, one readable column. Did that. I would wake up, you know, a couple hours before work, spend time doing that 3 days a week. Eventually, from doing that, I got an opportunity to write a little bit. Wrote about fantasy hoops, you know, in the beginning.
What year is this? What's the time frame?
This is my 11th year covering the NBA.
Wow.
So 10 seasons ago. This was, you know, 2006, 2007, right around there. And 2005, 2006. Yeah, right in that time frame. So eventually, long story long, I got an opportunity to kind of write a little bit more about the Knicks and kind of spread my legs. I never took any journalism classes in school. All my experience and learning was kind of on the job, figuring out, you know, not speaking first person and passive voice and, you know, all that other stuff. Luckily, I had a liberal arts degree, so it was a sociology, you know, concentration sociology and literature. So I had a familiarity, or at least, somewhat of a background and, writing and, you know, putting your thoughts, you know, the way to express yourself or articulate, you know, what you were thinking. But a lot of it just came from, that experience of learning how to write by being a bad writer.
Sure. Your style clearly belies that you've read Sports Illustrated and the Newsday and the Times sports section since you were 8 years old.
No question. Yeah. I mean, other kids read Moby Dick or comic books. I read Sports Illustrated. I read Sean Powell and Newsday and Lupica and the Daily News and, you know, Sports Illustrated. And I think, you know, around that time, Sports Guy was, you know, kind of really becoming big on ESPN.
Holy Cross alum.
Yes. A fellow Holy Crosser.
So, some great writers out of Holy Cross. Right? John Favreau, speechwriter.
Yeah. He was actually in sociology classes of mine when I was at Holy Cross. So, it was just, like you said, it was the experience of I guess I'd been, in a way, I had never prepared to become a sports writer, but in a way I'd been preparing my whole life.
Sure. And you've been doing it, like you said, for the last 10 years. You're a credentialed NBA writer. You're in the locker room, or at least you lie that you're in the locker room in your filings.
That's been one of the cooler experiences, and certainly
for the Knicks and the Nets.
Yeah, I have a season credential for the Knicks. I've had it for the past seven. This will be my seventh season.
Was it tough to get out of Hoops World and then Basketball Insiders? Or?
It wasn't as difficult as you probably would think it would be. Luckily, I piggybacked on Hoops World. I had a, you know, relatively solid reputation, even back then. And the NBA has been really cool with embracing online journalism, as opposed to some other sports where it's kind of, if you don't write for the Daily News or the Newsday or the Boston Globe, you know, you're not counted, you know. And there's still some of that, you know, that double standard, some of that, you know, kind of snobbery still exists. But as we've seen, as newspapers have declined in popularity, you know, websites have obviously increased. So every day that you get your season credential at media day every year. And every year when I get it, I look at it and like think that's pretty cool from a kid that grew up in Long Island, you know, obsessed and loving the Knicks. Now is a chance to cover the Knicks, on a day-to-day basis. Pretty cool.
How long does it take you to get over any awe? And maybe not even with the Knicks, you've been around them, but when LeBron James or Steph Curry walks in, How do you shut off being a fan and focus on getting the job done?
It happens quicker than you think, and that's kind of one of the negatives. If you want to call it a negative, I'm not really. I don't even know if I'd consider myself a Knicks fan anymore. You know, because once you peek behind the curtain, it changes the perspective. It's difficult to root for guys, root for players in the same way because you see that you, especially as a kid, care a lot more about wins and losses than a lot of players do. You know, a lot of players quickly brush off, you know, any type of defeat and, you know, getting ready to go out and, you know, talking about, you know, it doesn't linger with them. I guess it's just one of those things where you familiarize yourself with it. If you had the most amazing chef prepare you a steak every night for dinner.
Action Bronson's dad.
Exactly. If you had Action Bronson cook you, you know, roasted lamb and fennel and the most, you know, Mario Batali made the side dishes and, you know, Bobby Flay barbecued, you know, every night you came home to that, For the first night, you'd be overwhelmed. Your senses, you couldn't take it. You'd be so excited. You probably wouldn't even finish your meal because the second night, a little bit less, 2 weeks, 2 months down the road. Yeah, this is cool. What's up, guys? Maybe we change it up tonight. You know, like, I think there's something to, as you know, you just eventually, you know, like that kind of awe, certainly does wear off, you know, probably sooner rather than later.
I couldn't sleep for like 3 hours after Conor McGregor got tapped the other night. And I'm a 36-year-old man. But who are some of your favorite interviews from around the league? Maybe on the Knicks first, and then the folks that you've enjoyed talking to the most from outside of the metropolitan area.
Sure. You know, and as far as the Knicks go, it's been difficult. And my experience is probably different than a lot of other folks that have covered other teams. It's certainly, I talk to guys around the league when they come through New York, or, you know, other guys that work for Basketball Insiders, you know, when we'll have conference calls and things like that. The Knicks make it very difficult for you to conduct interviews, you know, have time alone with players, whereas other, you know, teams even encourage that, let alone facilitate that. The Knicks are very, they do their best to create an arm's length distance between players and the media. But that said, there's still certain players. Jamal Crawford has probably been the best in terms of.
Did you ever play against him? Didn't he go to prep school in Connecticut? Or?
No, he was a West Coast. He was a Seattle guy.
Isaiah Thomas says that I think I might be mixing up names, but that Jamal went to school on the East Coast, and then Isaiah went in the mid-2000s.
Jamal went to Michigan.
Okay.
Yeah. So he played in Michigan, but he went to the same high school as either Isaiah Thomas or Nate Robinson, but all those guys are
from Washington.
Yeah, yeah. Seattle. Yeah. That's a hotbed. A lot of great players.
Zach LaVine.
Yeah. There's a fraternity of those guys. You know, you talk to them about it. Crawford was just, you know, the kindest, you know, really, you know, he treated me as with the same sincerity and looked me in the eyes and gave me the same time as he would Howard Beck, who's writing for the Times, or Isola, who's writing for the Daily News, you know, or, you know, guys, you know, for, you know, that would come, you know, only at one, you know, he just was a real genuine guy, the kind of guy you would want your son to treat people the way, you know, he treated other people. So, David Lee was a really good interview. Always took time, and
he's a Chaminade grad.
Chaminade, St. Louis. Right. I talked to him about that actually. our shared Chaminade roots. He was
Marianist really values.
Exactly. He was a good dude. To be honest, most of the guy, Malik Rose, was a good interview back then. Nate Robinson was funny. You know, he wasn't. I don't know if I'd call him the best interview, but certainly entertaining and interesting. Marbury was one of a kind.
What's he up to now? Is he still in China?
He is. He's actually, like, rehabilitated his image, and they're building a statue to him. And
they did a play, success. Didn't they? Yes. A musical?
Yes. It's been amazing the turnaround he's had. He was a character. It was definitely more, you know, the people were kinder and nicer. Then you think once Isaiah came, that's when really the media, you know, changed. It's, you know, that's when the dynamic changed, where the media was seen as the enemy, you know, as opposed to a kind of a cooperative effort here. Let's, you know, we both have a job to do. Let's respect each other, and we can both promote each other and make our lives better and or easier. But once the Isaiah stuff and Dolan kind of cracked the whip, and you know, that's when things kind of took a turn, set down south.
Have you ever sat with Phil Jackson or had a chance to talk with him, or they keep him at arm's length too?
He talks so incredibly. I've never personally talked with him one-on-one. I've been in press conferences with him. I think he's talked to the media total twice.
Oh, wow.
This entire season. So, it's certainly something that annoys Knicks writers. You know, that their livelihood depends on, you know, getting good quotes, and certainly compared to other, you know, coaches and general managers around the league, the Knicks do the bare minimum.
What's the press corps like? Are you friends, or is there like a rivalry? How does that work?
It's all friendly. I mean, Isola and Mark Berman joke around about, you know, there was more of a rivalry. I think it's now at the stage of the game where the one thing that the Madison Square Garden, you know, having kind of created an us against them approach, where the Knicks against us, against the media was them. So all the thems kind of felt in the group together, you know, kind of built a camaraderie. So, I don't travel with the team. The guys that do travel with the team have a good relationship. You know, Ian Begley's a great guy, works for ESPN, and, you know, he gets along with Berman, and, you know, I saw, you know, they all, you know, each of those guys, you know, I've certainly never had anything but, you know, positive experience for the most part with most of those guys.
And did you ever learn anything other than reading from them or observing them? Are there any lessons that you take away?
Definitely. Like I said, I never took a journalism course, so the learning thing was major for me. And to their credit, two guys that helped me out a ton were Howard Beck. He was covering the Knicks for the New York Times at the time, and Alan Hahn was working for Newsday. And to this day, those guys, I was talking to Howard not too long ago. I see him, you know, at the Garden and stuff. Alan works at MSG, and Howard works for BleacherReport.com, which is interesting in and of itself. You know, we talked about the, you know, divergence from newspaper. You know, Howard left the New York Times for at .com, which, you know, if you would have told me the day I started 10 years ago that that was a possibility, would have been crazy. But yeah, so just the way to handle yourself, there's certain things you got to figure out. You know, if somebody's in a one-on-one in a locker room talking to a player, give that guy his time until he steps away. You know, don't step in on his, you know, one-on-one. There's, you know, which players talk, don't talk before the game. Kevin Garnett, my first game, I'm nervous as heck. This was in Jersey. I was covering a Nets game at the, when the Nets were playing in Jersey. I asked Garnett a question. He looked at me like I had two, it was before game. He said, "Don't you no, I don't speak pregame. Fuck you talking." You know, so it was that kind of thing. Learned my lesson there.
How did he do that night?
I forget. I had to go change my pants. I might have missed the first quarter. Darren Williams, I called him Duran. It was one of the when he was with the Jazz his rookie year. Me and my buddy Wendell Maxey went to interview him. And he said, "You think I'm gonna speak to you when you don't even know my first name?" So wow. It's things like that that you learn.
How did your last college game go, Duran?
Yeah.
How's Luther Head doing?
I should have asked you that. I should have had a Fighting Illini t-shirt underneath my. There's certainly learned experiences, just respect it within the locker room, even within the press room. You know, Mark Berman has AOL. He has AOL Mail, so every time he opens his computer, he says, "You've got mail." Still to this day, and people, you know, so you just learn about how to handle your business and go about your business. A lot of it was on the job training. Yeah,
that's funny. And how have you seen the game change in the last decade? You mentioned that you'd never believe that somebody would leave the New York Times, the old gray lady, to go to BleacherReport.com. Have you seen other changes in the last decade?
100%. I mean, you know, it's funny. I was thinking about this today, and I'm going to write about it probably next week. And I'll start really putting the figures together. But there's a report today that Dwight Howard is interested in signing with the Knicks.
I saw that.
You know, and, you know, if you would have told a Knicks fan, you know, a couple of years ago that they'd have a chance to get, another dominant low post, whether you like Dwight Howard or not, you know, I'm personally not a big fan. But the point is, it's very difficult to win with big men in the NBA this season. You know, who's the best big men in the NBA? DeMarcus Cousins, Anthony Davis, Karl Anthony Towns, you know, probably the, you know, three best centers, Marc Gasol, you know, maybe in the game today. You know, those three guys are not going to make the playoffs this season. You need a point guard. You need guards that can be able to penetrate into the paint. Steph Curry's, Russell Westbrook's, you know, Kyrie Irving's, you know, LeBron's more of a passer and a facilitator and a, you know, penetrator than he is a, typical, you know, back to the best big man. So you just, you know, Durant and the best players in the NBA, when you look at, you know, Harden, when you look at points in the paint, it used to be Ewing and David Robinson and Shaq, you know, now it's guys like Steph Curry, Tony Parker, Russell Westbrook, you know, it's just the way the game has changed. I mean, Steph Curry's hit 300 three-pointers this season, you know, like a stat for you, Larry Bird, you know, won the MVP in 1985-86. He led the league in three-pointers that season as well, hit 92 threes that year. You know,
I mean, this is like Babe Ruth in 1924,
yes,
right?
Yes. I mean, it's the equivalent of, I forget who did it. I, You know, somebody basically said it's the equivalent of somebody hitting 106 home runs or something in a season. It's what Steph Curry's going to do. He's going to end up close to 400. And the what?
Are you implying Steph is on steroids?
He's on shooting steroids or something. Yeah, it's just crazy. You know, like it'd be the equivalent of somebody averaging 55 rebounds or, you know, 37 assists. You know, it's just something. So, yeah, to directly answer your question, the game has definitely changed. I mean, you know, I grew up on the Starks, Knicks, and Ewing and Oakley and those guys, and hand checking and physical defense, and, you know, 75 to 73 scores against the Pacers in the Eastern Conference Finals. You know, the Warriors will score that in a half now, you know. Sure. So it's a different world in terms of the way the game is played, the way the game is officiated, and the way you need to build a successful team. I mean, look at the Knicks. They have a good front court. Carmelo, Kristaps Porzingis, and Robin Lopez. And they're a terrible team. You know, they're right near the bottom. They're one of the worst teams. They're three. They've lost 16 of the last 19 games.
Because they don't have guards.
Because they don't have guards. You know, it's Jose Calderon and Sasa Vujacic, and Flalo's decent. But if you don't have guards, you can't win in today's NBA.
Not to steal Bill Simmons' thunder, but I loved the jag that he had about if Anthony Mason and Xavier McDaniel and Oakley had to play against the Warriors, they'd be fighting to see who would take Steph out in the first quarter.
Seriously, that's something I've wrote about that too. I mean, it's just, I'm shocked that there hasn't been any flagrant fouls on Steph Curry. I mean, because he dances too. He dances in the sidelines. You know, he lets you know. Listen, nobody can stop him, so he has every right to do it. But yeah, that's a great point. I mean, I'm shocked there hasn't been more physical play against Steph Curry. I saw Gilbert Arenas talking somewhere. Maybe it was on Instagram. I think it was an Instagram post or something. Just ran.
A lot of hashtags. I'm envisioning the post.
A ton of hashtags. Maybe some uncomplimentary, you know, terms about WNBA players. But basically was saying, if I'm playing Steph Curry, I'm basically running a triangle and two, and I'm not letting him catch the ball, and, you know, let those other guys beat me, which I think somebody's going to try eventually.
Yeah. But is Klay Thompson the second best shooter in there?
Yeah. I mean, that's, and Draymond Green might be the, you know, it might be the MVP of the team, you know, when you really think about it. So the Warriors definitely have something special. So, but even so, you know, we know Steph Curry's going to beat you. The other guys will probably beat you anyway, but at least find out.
Are the Warriors going to beat the Spurs in the playoffs? Are they going to beat Oklahoma City in the playoffs?
Yeah, I find they're just so balanced. I mean, listen, Andre Iguodala was the MVP of the finals last year. You know, that speaks to their depth, the system they have in place. You know, you talk about being in the right place at the right time and making a good decision. Steve Kerr was this close from accepting the Knicks job, 2 years ago, and now he's, you know, this close to winning, you know, the best, you know, the back-to-back titles and possibly the best regular season in league history. So, but yeah, I respect the Spurs. I'll never disrespect the Spurs. And, you know, we're not talking about the Spurs, and that's exactly the way they want it. But, you know, the Spurs are what, 56-6, or, you know, they've only lost six times in 65 games this season. It's tough to see them losing four times in seven games. So when you think of it in those terms, I think they're going to advance to the finals. I think the Cavs, actually, I'm higher on the Cavs than most. I know they're struggling. But I think that if you're going to make an argument and you're going to play devil's advocate and say, do the Cavs have a chance to beat the Warriors should they come out of the West? Maybe the Cavs will have a lot easier path to the finals. So, but yeah, gun to my head, as Mike and the Mad Dog would say, I got to take the Warriors.
Good call by you. I remember when we were in high school, we used to eat lunch together, and what was it, 95-96, the Bulls team, who had the best record of all
95-96, 72-10, yeah.
And you were able to rattle off everyone that had beaten the Bulls that season, and you just, you like couldn't believe that you were in a position to actually know the 10 losses that they had an entire year. Like, that blew your mind. And I always think of that when I look at the record with the Golden State now.
Jeff Van Gundy's first win as a Knicks coach was on a Sunday afternoon against, it was their Bulls. I think it was the Bulls' ninth loss that season, but they'd only lost X number of games at that point. And the Knicks smoked them by like 30 at the Garden on a Sunday afternoon. That was Van Gundy's first win as a Knicks coach.
I think I saw, it was the same, like the same point in the season, exactly, as the Lakers lost to Golden State.
Same day. Yeah. Yeah. It literally might have been the same day. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
It was a blowout and everything,
yep,
like that.
Yeah.
So you have a great story, and I wanted to hit on that. But one of the things that I really wanted to dig my teeth into you, into with you, is the Kristaps Porzingis piece that you posted a couple weeks ago. You really went in depth. I told you, you know, I could see myself being a 14-year-old boy opening up a Sports Illustrated magazine and reading this article. It just, you spoke to a number of people that had ties to Latvia, that followed Porzingis, and it just really shows how basketball is flattening borders and bringing people together. And I wanted to dig in a little bit on that piece that you wrote. And I'll link it in the show notes.
Thank you.
Because everybody should take the time to read. Anybody that's listening to this podcast should definitely take the time to read an article like this. We'll go into detail here, but maybe walk me through the mechanics of how you wrote this article. Tell me a little bit about it and how it played out.
Sure. It's an interesting story. First of all, thank you. Appreciate the compliment very much. It kind of fell into my lap in a way. It was in January, middle of January, like a week before my birthday. And somebody had tweeted me and asked me, is Porzingis playing tonight? He had like a shoulder injury or something. He's questionable. And I said, we should know about 5:30. And he writes back, LOL, you know, smiley face or something. That's 22:30 my time. I go, what do you mean? You know, I was
okay, Marine.
exactly.
At ease.
Exactly. I said, all right, well, you do a couple push-ups and, you know, let the barracks will be open. So then he explained, you know, I'm actually from Latvia and we stay up to watch a game. Me and my dad are going to stay up to watch the game. And I say, wait, what? So we had it back and forth, and I almost honestly I didn't even believe him. He tweeted me a picture of his cell. You know, took a screen
proof of life
picture, hold the newspaper of the alarm on his cell phone. You know, for 2,200 hours, and I was like, wow, you know, this kid's for real. So we had a couple tweets back and forth, and then he sent me a direct message that night of him and his dad watching the game and like having a thing of popcorn, a cup of coffee or something. And I go, holy cow, it's amazing. You know, cause as a, you know, we mentioned that I haven't been a Knicks fan in a long time, but Porzingis is, he looped me back in. I got my daughter a Porzingis jersey. You know, it's the first thing, one of the first things I bought her.
They make Porzingis jerseys for 9 month olds.
Honestly, they didn't. I had to get it like on the one of those bootleg sites, you know, like that. And it didn't even say, it wasn't even Knicks, it just said Porzingis, exclamation point, and on a pink onesie. Now they do sell Porzingis jerseys at six months and 9 months at the Garden, but they didn't at the time. This was his first couple months in the league. As somebody who you know, thought that Porzingis, you know, would be able to bring the Knicks back, yada, yada, yada. Long story short, we were having a couple conversations. Then he sent me some direct messages, and we were going back and forth. And I said, "Do any of your friends also stay up to watch? I mean, how many, you know?" And that kind of sparked the idea in my mind. He goes, "Yeah, my buddy Tim, whatever his name was, my buddy Gustav, you know, goes to school with me, and you know, we talk about it. Sometimes we miss school because of it. And it just something clicked, and I said, you know what? I think it'd be interesting to see what kind of culture there is. The other thing that started was I retweeted what he sent me, the picture of his cell phone, and said, look at this guy. You know, you guys think, you know, you guys are dedicated Knicks fans. Check this out. And I must have got 30 replies. I'm in Spain. I do the same thing. I go to school in London. We go instead of studying, we go to the bar. You know, NBA League Pass. And there's a lot of streaming sites that these kids watch. These, you know, and God, adults.
You're making Adam Silver so happy right now.
But I'm telling you, it is the truth, because I got so many replies and responses. You know, he's not the only one. You know, in Albania, in Algeria. You know, and I don't have a large Twitter, I'm not Adam Schefter with a million followers.
Kim Kardashian
or Kanye. Or Bill Simmons, you know. But there's such a dedicated, you know, there's a pool of dedicated fans, of like-minded fans. So that's when it really sparked my imagination and said, I want to find out what it's like to be a Kristaps Porzingis fan in Latvia. And that kind of got the ball rolling.
And for, I'm envisioning my mom listening to this right now. Who is Kristaps Porzingis? How did you find out about him, and why is he so important in your life?
Sure. So the Knicks haven't had a draft pick in the top five since 1986, Kenny Walker out of Kentucky. Obviously, they had Patrick Ewing in 85, he was a great player, and he kind of changed the franchise around them. They won the lottery, and there's, did that Knicks have it fixed? Was their frozen envelope, yada, yada, yada.
86 was a horrible draft, though,
yes,
right?
Yeah. So it wasn't like they passed on anybody.
I'm sorry, Brad Dard.
long story short, the Knicks haven't had a quality, over the past few years, they've traded away the draft picks. For the last 15 years or so, the Knicks have been terrible.
Took Frederick Weiss instead of Ron Artest.
Absolutely. 15 over 16.
Remember that?
Yeah, I remember that all too well. As a St. John's fan, that was devastating. I was hoping they would take Ron Artest. And even I wanted to take LeVar Postel the year after. So when the Knicks finally had an opportunity to get a franchise-changing talent in the 2015 NBA draft, this was something that somebody covering the team was, you know, you're really hoping that nobody wants to read about a losing team year after year after year. It gets old. Yes, it's funny and it's entertaining, but, you know, at the Garden, the gym is quiet. It's dead. And there were games last year when the Knicks won 17 games, they're worst in franchise history. Media row, there was literally guys playing solitaire on their computer during games, you know, playing, you know, nobody's paying attention. So you hope that there's somebody that can reinvigorate the franchise. And this 2015 draft was supposed to be a really, really great draft. In particular, there were three potential superstar players, Karl-Anthony Towns, D'Angelo Russell, and Jahlil Okafor. So as long as the Knicks got one of those top three picks, they should be good. Up until the last week of the season, they had the worst record in the NBA, which guaranteed them a top three pick at worst. And at best, they had the best chance of getting the number one pick. They ended up winning the final two road games of the season. And in the lottery, dropped all the way to four. Knicks fans go crazy, sad, angry. The same old Knicks again. They're going to miss out on one of those top three players. Who are they going to take it for? Should they take a Justice Winslow or a, you know, Kaminsky? Or, you know, should they trade down or trade for a player? Phil Jackson, to his credit, ends up selecting Kristaps Porzingis, guard. You know, the draft was in Brooklyn, actually. Plays Bulls. Knicks fans go crazy. Who is this guy?
The one nerdy kid was crying.
Where were you?
Were you watching at home?
I was watching it at home. Yes, I did not go to Brooklyn. Because I had to write, I had to write an immediate reaction for it. That's who I wanted the Knicks to pick, given the dearth of.
Really?
Yeah. I wanted the Knicks to pick Porzingis. Partly because I thought he'd be good. I didn't know. I certainly didn't know he'd be this good. But partly because I'd seen the YouTube highlights and the clips, and he was working out in Las Vegas at the Impact Gym. There's a gym outside the Strip in Las Vegas where, you know, a lot of NBA players practice and prepare. Guys that had been there and played against them said, this kid's the truth. He's going to be really good. Probably just as importantly, it made a great story. I mean, could this kid overcome the stereotypes, you know, thin, European, soft, skinny, white kid? Could he deliver the goods? It'd be interesting if he could, and, you know, prove the doubters wrong would make it that much more special. Just from a human interest sports journalism side, you know, as journalists, we root for the story. You know, you root for Peyton Manning to win that last game because it's the better story. So when Porzingis got drafted, and just seeing him and the initial, the initial summer league experience, you know, watching him play, it seemed really good. Had a chance to interview him and talk to him during the press availability, you know, leading up to his rookie season. There was something special there. It was impossible to ignore, and to see him play that, and he played really, really well right off the bat. Exceeded all expectations, even the highest expectations. So you could tell it was something special was going on. We were witnessing possibly the rebirth of the Knicks franchise, because the Knicks aren't going to be great with the current current cast of characters they have. If the Knicks are ever going to be really good again, and not just an eighth seed or, you know, in the middle of the playoffs, it's going to be because Porzingis becomes something really special. So having a player reinvigorate the franchise and the city, because New York City loves hoops, so having a player that they could get behind was something that was exciting.
And we'll get to Latvia and Europe in a second, his popularity over there. But why do you think he became so popular here? Was it because the expectations were so low and he exceeded them? Is it because he totally flipped the script on all the things you were talking about?
I definitely think that setting the bar low is important. But even if it was high, he played really well.
The way he carries himself?
To me, I think it's the way he carries himself both on and off the court. I mean, on the court, he plays with a swagger and he plays with a confidence that's kind of jarring, almost alarming. You don't expect that, a 20-year-old kid to be able to have that confidence in himself. But at the same time, off the court, it's humble. There's a humble attitude he takes. He's, he doesn't put on airs. He doesn't, he understands he's lucky. He understands he's in a privileged position. I'll give you, for instance, during his first shoot around at the Garden, before his first game, he's putting up shots, knocking down threes, and he's a 7'3" guy, and he dunks, and there's a lot of excitement to his game. But he's shooting around, finishes shooting around, and he shakes the trainer's hands, and then he goes to each ball boy and shakes their hands and says, "Thank you for rebounding for me." And listen, will he do that 2 years from now, let alone 2 months from now? Probably not. Because you get hardened and you got to get back and, you got to get prepared and stretch and, look at game film and get opponents. But there's a lot of credit goes to his family. He's raised really well. He had two older brothers that played in Latvia.
They're tall too.
They're tall, 6'5", not as tall as Kristaps. Yeah. He's by far and away the tallest in his family. Michael Jordan's brothers were 5'10" and Jordan 6'6".
He's in the Air Force.
So I think that it's that combination of talent, skill, excitement, the way he plays, the way he dunks, the way he shoots, and the way he carries himself. I think he and the fact that he wanted to come to New York, I think that that struck a chord with New Yorkers.
Did you talk to him for the story?
I did not.
Was that a conscious choice?
It was.
Why?
Because it wasn't about me. It wasn't about him. It wasn't about my opinion. It wasn't about New Yorkers. It wasn't about Knicks fans that had been through the disappointment of Ewing and had their heart broken by Jordan. It wasn't about people in Queens or Long Island or New Jersey that had watched the Knicks all their life and wanted to, were hoping that this was strictly about through the eyes of someone who'd never watched a lot of the people I talked to had never watched the Knicks game before. Now they set their alarm at 3:30 a.m. and had watched 50 straight Knicks games, I talked to Kristaps about the story I was writing, and because I talked to some players that he had followed as a kid. I got in touch with some of those other players, and I talked to Kristaps' brother, Giannis, who was kind of one of his agents. He works for ASM, Andy Miller's agency. And just kind of told him what I was doing. But I went back and forth whether I wanted to include his perspective and his family's perspective and Knick fans in New York's perspective. But at the end of the day, I ended up fortunately having so much great material that I had to cut out a ton of it. So it kind of made my decision for me. I had so much good stuff otherwise that I didn't feel I needed his opinion.
When you talk to him, he speaks flawless English, right?
Yes.
How's he acclimating to living in the capital of the world?
It's amazing. It's literally as impressive as he is, as his numbers are and his performance on the court. I think the way he's handled himself under this media spotlight, he's drafted when he was 19, turned 20, as a 20-year-old kid, is mind-boggling. I could barely handle myself at college. 200 miles north of my parents' house. This is a kid on the other side of the world.
You said he wanted to come to New York.
That's what he wanted.
Why?
He felt that was the best position for him. His brother and he basically had been preparing himself for this the whole time. He could have been drafted the year before, and he was guaranteed that the Orlando Magic, who had the 5th pick in this draft, had I think it was the 12th pick or the 10th pick in the 2014 draft, and they promised them, "Listen, you come out, we're taking you. You won't fall." You got a guarantee. That's basically what you want. But he said, "Nah, I'm not ready yet. I want to come in when I'm ready," and he didn't really want Orlando. He didn't work out for other teams in the lottery. He the Knicks was where he wanted to go. He actually hurt his thigh in the one-on-one workout he had with Phil Jackson and Steve Mills in the Knicks front office, and he thought that might cost him his opportunity, so he was heartbroken. He wanted New York, and fortunately New York wanted him.
What did you learn? Has Kristaps Porzingis helped the United States in any way? Has it enhanced our the perception of our country overseas?
I would say, the first impression wasn't a favorable one, because these kids, these guys, the Latvians were up at, the draft would have been around 7:32. So it was, 2:30 in the morning, and they stayed up because obviously they wanted to see where he was going. And the first thing is the guy gets booed mercilessly. And they would tell me, how could Knicks fans do this? They don't never seen him play. Why would they boo a guy? But to their credit, a lot of them, wrote that, I read about the history of the draft, the Knicks fans, it's kind of an annual tradition, no matter how good the player is. So, that kind of made it easier. But, I think Knicks fans, Latvians have more of an affinity for New Yorkers now. They kind of feel like they're on the same team at least.
And how great is it that they, through the power of social media, they're contacting you to ask about injury reports on the Knicks roster?
To me, it's a fascinating, I think it speaks to not only the global impact of the game, but the ways in which the game finds people like-minded fans. I mean, I talked to a lot of Latvians, and a lot would stay up and watch the game at 3:30, but some had families and jobs that, a lot of them couldn't do it. On the weekends they would, but during the week they couldn't. But as soon as they woke up, they'd pick up their phone, and all their friends would post Facebook highlights of, the dunks, the highlights, the game recap, his box score. It'd be on Vine and Twitter. So they wouldn't miss a beat. It's amazing that the coverage, especially once there is a vested interest, as there was with the Knicks and in Porzingis, it became incredibly easy for them to get information.
Are they basketball fans or are they Kristaps Porzingis fans?
Most of them were basketball fans before. Kristaps kind of went on their national radar. Latvia is a country of about 1.9 million. In northeastern Europe,
like Nassau County.
Exactly. It literally is, Queens is, 3.9 million and, Brooklyn. So yeah, it's literally the size of a New York City borough. They've had some success in other sports. They had
hockey,
bobsled. There's a big bobsled community.
Yeah. You don't screw with that being bobsled.
No.
Steve Holcomb doesn't sleep at night.
So when there was whenever there was an opportunity to support any of the athletes, they were right behind them. People send me YouTube videos of the volleyball team that placed that won a bronze in the Rio Olympic, the last Olympics,
London.
Before the London Olympics, and they came back and it was crazy outside right from the airport. There was just literally. They're huge sports fans, especially for somebody that represents them, that represents their country. But some of them were basketball fans. A lot of them stated they had seen Jordan play. They'd stay up to watch Jordan games. And Andres Beatrice, who was a center for the Warriors in 2007-2008, was also of Latin descent. So they had they don't like him now because they felt he wasted his opportunity and wasted his talent. But they do feel that was their kind of their original indoctrination into the NBA. But after he left, they stopped following because it really takes a commitment. A lot of the guys, pretty much all the most of the people that I spoke to that were crazy Porzingis fans, that getting up 2:30, three nights a week, were already basketball fans, and then were happy to follow the journey. There was a couple I spoke to. This one guy was a pastor, and he wasn't a huge basketball fan. He's a sports fan, but not a huge basketball fan. But he got swept up in the Porzingis thing, and he'd stay up and watch.
There's a rich history. I mean, James Naismith was a pastor, and there's a rich history of missionaries bringing the game to the far reaches of the planet. So it's interesting to hear that. But basketball is, soccer is king. But I think that basketball feels like they're on the precipice of overtaking them. And from our American point of view, there are 300 million of us.
But there are 7.5 billion people on the planet, and I think the smart leagues are looking outside the borders, and the NFL is going to have a day of reckoning here eventually, I imagine. But basketball is really well positioned to overtake soccer. I don't think that's unrealistic, and it does very well reaching every corner of the planet.
Yeah, I think certainly from the American perspective of the four major sports here in America, hockey's big in certain European countries, obviously as well. But in terms of their global reach, the NBA is so far ahead. And I think a lot of that's credit to Adam Silver and his team at the NBA because they've embraced social media, which is a key component.
You were hitting a lot of the internal talking points just about hearing you talk about Vines and checking on social media in the morning, the scores. The league is very, very pleased to hear that. And watching the game on your tablet or phone is becoming crucial to the game's growth overseas.
Definitely, without question, that's something that allowed them. There was in years past. Kobe Bryant famously would have to wait for VHS tapes from his uncle to watch the Lakers and the Celtics. Great matchups. Today, that Kobe, that basketball obsessed. 12-year-old kid doesn't have to wait for UPS shipments of VHS tapes. He can watch it from a smartphone in his bedroom, Yep. So that completely changed the dynamic, and the NBA being so willing to embrace, not only allow it, but promote it and incorporate it into their platform, I think speaks well to their initiatives. And I think it's going to, we've already seen the influx of European talent in recent years, and I think that's only going to increase as we go forward.
And it's going to move east and south, although it already you see how popular the game is in South America, in Africa. Baseball prides itself on the number of international players, and it does a great job, and historically it does, but it's Korea and Japan, Taipei, the DR, and a couple sprinkled here and there. Basketball's everywhere.
Everywhere.
And you don't need the equipment. It's a couple hoops. And I mean, even if you have a trash can, you want to throw your crumpled up piece of paper in it.
100%.
It's like human nature.
Yeah.
Who else is international on the Knicks?
Vujicic.
Yeah, sure.
Calderon from Spain. To this day, I mean, we talk about Twitter. If I say anything negative about Calderon, there's fan pages and people on Twitter, yeah, but you don't recognize this, and
soccer moms.
yeah. It's legit. The Seraphin.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
From France. So
nice,
yeah.
Nice guy.
Yeah. So there's I might be forgetting one or two, but
Patrick Ewing.
Really, he could bring him back as coach. it's every team now is more of a United Nations. And I think what's interesting about Porzingis was the way he embraced American culture, because he was so familiar with it prior to coming to the United States.
He had cornrows.
He had cornrows when he was 12 years old, because Allen Iverson and Melo and those guys, I think, that kind of says, he's just, rappers and hip hop culture. And, he's very comfortable. After games, he'll give interviews in three languages, English, Spanish, and Latvian, and he can speak fluently in all three of them.
How's the Spanish? It's good.
Pretty good. Pretty good.
Because he played where? Barcelona? Or?
Played in Seville. Yeah.
Seville.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. Miss Olivia,
Oliva, Senora,
Senora, Oliva.
She'd be very proud.
Our Spanish teacher, from what I can tell, he's pretty good. No, I'm not. The last time I took a Spanish class, he's amazing. His grasp of language and his ability to comfortably navigate the media spotlight has been amazing.
So I think we did a good job. Was there anything that I missed that I should have asked about the article? Or?
It was amazing to me to learn about these people's experiences and how personally invested they were. The pride, the really national pride. It was, it was bursting through. He moved from just, as kind of a stardom roles, and he got recognition, one rookie of the month, for the Eastern Conference 3 months in a row. It was more than just the basketball players, and the future. He holds so much promise for the future. He's only 20 years old. So many Latvians talked about how he's that's what the Latvian kids will look up to. And because he's not just a great, you know, great player, but he's a great person off the court. So he really has reached a, almost deity status there.
Well, and national pride can go a couple ways. I think the feeling I got from reading your article is more like, here is our crown jewel, and we want to share it with you know, the world, the leader of the free world in the U.S. And on the highest platform possible.
100% is a good point. And I talked to Giannis, Kristaps' brother, about it, a little bit about with Porzingis as well, and also the fans, because I was almost thinking to myself, like, well, one of the questions I would ask them is, what's going to happen when he goes home? You know, is it going to be a big celebration? And they were like, yes, definitely, but when he's walking down the street, we don't bother him. We'll choose not to. There's not that TMZ culture that we're familiar with, you know. Like, in other words, as popular as he is in Latvia, it'd be much easier for him to go get coffee than it would be to go to Starbucks on Fifth Avenue, because there's a different, you know, there's different reverences, different respect for individuals. You know, we don't have that we seem to have lost our way somehow in America.
Were you covering the Knicks during Linsanity?
I was.
Did you see any parallels there?
Yeah, I think Linsanity, it was kind of more of a sense that this probably wasn't going to last, so let's make the most of it and live it up as much as we can. Whereas this, you know, it's more of just the beginning phases. I think that's what most excites Knicks fans, because it's kind of the birth. You're at the, you know, you're watching that band, you know, before they do their first hit record, and everyone says, now.
I was on Dave Matthews in 91.
Correct. Everyone wants to be that guy that they knew Nirvana before, you know, before it was cool to do so, you know, and then the Posers start getting the t-shirts and stuff. So I think for Knicks fans, those first couple months of Porzingis' rookie year, it was kind of a cult that had formed, that, you know, this is our guy. And, you know, we're ahead of the curve. You guys will all, everyone's going to come on the bandwagon, but we're here now. Isn't this exciting?
With Jeremy Lin, did you see a spike in followership from Asia?
100%. I had the good fortune to interview Walt Clyde Frazier maybe a year ago, 16 months ago. It was when he...
I would love to transcribe that.
It was really cool. He likes apple juice. We were... because he was at his restaurant, he was promoting his restaurant, so I got to sit down, talk to him for a while, I asked him a whole bunch of questions, how he didn't want to get drafted by the Knicks, he didn't think he would, a whole bunch of cool stuff, one of the questions I asked him, what's the loudest the Garden's ever been? You know, LJ's 4-point play, you know, you were either there for games when Willis came out of the tunnel, or you were calling the games, and, you know, obviously been around the Garden a long time. Linsanity.
Wow.
I said, no, you know, I know recently that you know, this is the loudest. No, but I'm talking about in all the years, you know, when Willis worked out of the tunnel and everything, and, you know, or when you know, you guys won the championship right after. No, Linsanity, without question, undoubtedly, he said. He probably rhymed some of the words, I forget now at the time. But he said without a doubt it was Linsanity. It was the loudest and most electric the Garden ever been in his lifetime. And he'd been there more than any of us. Yes, just from a media perspective, I'd never seen anything like Linsanity. I don't think we ever will. When the Knicks play in the playoffs, they haven't done too often. Instead of having the typical post game where you go and interview the guys at their locker after a game, they open up the press room where the coach talks before the games, and they'll have Carmelo come out or Paul George if they're playing the Pacers, whatever the case might be. There were so many people following the Knicks at a regular season games. I've covered the Knicks for, you know,
more than a decade
now, and I've been playoff games. There's never been more of a media contingent than there were for regular season meaningless games in February, in cold Februarys. Asia, Japan, all throughout Asia, South America, the Linsanity thing was really remarkable.
So basketball has just this fantastic track record of bringing people together of all stripes, backgrounds, nationalities.
Yeah,
and you've had a front row seat.
I've been blessed, and I think you know, we mentioned Porzingis. It's cool. Like, he's somehow the combination of all those cultures and melting pots. You know, he played in a tough, European league. You know, Seville and Spain. And that's kind of the next step. A lot of people think it's the next best league other than the NBA. He's kind of, you know, formed on the crucible of those fires, and to come to the NBA and to be able to get along with, you know, Melo and Aaron Aflalo and Calderon. He's just kind of in an interesting way, he's kind of the evolution of the NBA. He's a 7'3" guy who can guard point guards, who can shoot threes, who also is, you know, near the league lead in blocks.
And just as important, Tom, is that he can speak three languages.
Bingo. So in the way he's the evolution of the game, both in terms of his physical abilities on the court and also his the way he carries himself off the court and the way that he speaks three languages and is, you know, comes from Latvia, you know, faraway country, but still gets the same amount of respect. He's kind of the embodiment of the next phase of you know, especially the international game.
Last thing, get you out on here. What's going to happen in the offseason for the Knicks?
I'm of the opinion that it's best to be patient. Unfortunately, I think that the winds of discontent are blowing around the garden, and it's going to be very difficult for Phil Jackson to maintain the patience that he probably requires. The problem with the Knicks in the last 15 years, and the reason they've always been terrible, is because they're always looking for a quick fix. Never building the right way. Always, you know, let's just get this guy and then we'll be in the eighth seed and, you know, the Knicks will probably be pretty good and the fans won't have to deal with it. No, let the fans deal with a terrible product and build an organization the right way. Don't put a Band-Aid on a gaping wound. So my opinion, let 2016 keep your money in your pocket. They're probably going to have around $20 million in cap space. If you get a value contract, good. But don't spend all this money on Mike Conley. Mike Conley's a good player. And would make a lot of sense for a team that's one piece away. The Knicks aren't one piece away, so don't blow your allowance on a flashy piece of candy. Play it smart. Play it the right way. Go through one more rebuilding season. The Knicks have their draft pick in 2017.
Okay. Not this draft.
They don't have their draft pick this year. Best case scenario, they get a guy like Connolly and they win, you know, 37 games next year, 41 games, 44 games, depending on how good you think Connolly will be. And I personally am a fan of Connolly. I think he's a good player. But at that point, you'll be committed basically $50 million a year for him and Melo, you know, for 2017, 2018, 2019. So my thinking, it's certainly not popular because it requires the Knicks, I don't want to say tanking another season, but taking one step backwards to take three huge steps forward. In 2017, when you'd be looking at the cap jumps again to around 108 million. So Knicks could
theoretically,
yeah. Knicks could be looking at, you know, $30-40 million in cap space. 2017 free agent class: Russell Westbrook,
Durant,
Steph Curry, CP3, Kyle Lowry. Knicks need a point guard, as we talked about all those guys. Durant most likely he's actually going to be a free agent this season. But my assumption is he goes the LeBron route.
1 year.
One and one. You know, signed a 1 year, signed a 2 year deal with a 1 year opt out. So he'll probably be a free agent again in 2017. Maybe he convinced Westbrook and Durant to come to New York. You just give yourself a lot of options and the opportunity to land the true franchise changing talent. There's no, other than Durant, who's not going to sign with the Knicks this year, there's no guy that's going to change your franchise around. Give yourself the opportunity. Again, the goal should not be to make the playoffs and you know, get a sixth seed. The goal should be to win a championship. In years past, I would say it's next to impossible that a guy like Chris Paul or Russell Westbrook or Steph Curry would consider the Knicks. But now things have changed because Porzingis is in the picture.
It all comes back to Porzingis.
The future.
Tommy Beer, basketballinsiders.com. Thank you for your time. It was great catching up.
My pleasure, buddy.